I am here with Dan Carlin. Dan, how the hell are you?
Good, man. How are you? Long time no hear from.
Yeah, it's been too long. It's been years upon years, I think.
Yeah, a lot of water under the bridge.
I didn't look back, but it seems like we were probably talking in a different era.
Yeah, different reality. Yeah, for sure.
So let me just introduce you for those who, those few people who might not recognize you. You are a, you're one of the first podcasters. You really are the OG podcaster, and many of us believe the best who has ever lived thus far. I mean, you have several.
Disarming at the start, right? Yeah, there, Sam.
I usually, disarming tactic. Anyone who's heard this podcast knows I don't tend to butter up my guest with a ton of praise, but honestly, you have several series of the Hardcore History podcast that are just true masterpieces, and that is not an exaggeration. It's not a word I use very often. So congratulations, and thanks for taking the time to do this podcast.
It's first of all, very kind of you. And I feel like those of us, including yourself, who've been doing this for a lot of years, it's a fraternity that's grown by leaps and bounds in the last
just a little bit,
20% of its history or something. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something like 4.6 million podcasts, I'm told now. I'm not sure I believe that, but I can remember
when no one knew what it was. And it was a 45-minute conversation at a cocktail party when people say, "What do you do for a living?"
Yeah.
And you'd walk away after 45 minutes and they still wouldn't know.
Can you imagine starting a podcast now? I mean, how would that work?
I don't even know, unless you came in bringing your own sort of notoriety or popularity or audience with you, I don't know how you would grow from nothing. I mean, I know it happens and there's still people, but I don't know how I'd do it if you had to try to stand out in such a crowded field now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have resisted the slide into video. The ordeal of doing the setup for the last 20 minutes has convinced you that that is the right decision, no doubt. But
it's empathy, Sam. I have empathy for my audience, and they don't need to see this. They hear it. That's hard enough for some of them, especially with my loudness and softness variability. So we're doing as much to the audience as I think they deserve right now.
So now you release episodes on a, to call it a trickle is probably an exaggeration of your output at this point. I mean, you are clearly a perfectionist, and you just, I mean, I recall waiting with the rest of your fans for the next installment of one of your Hardcore History episodes. And it was like, you know, a 6-month wait. And essentially you're producing audiobooks without acknowledging that level of work. Give me your philosophy around that. I mean, it's so counter to what everyone else in podcasting feels they need to do to succeed.
Well, it sort of depends on the nature of the content. And in our case, we figured it out slowly. I mean, it was something we sort of came to the understanding over time that you're dealing with something that's sort of evergreen.
Right.
And when you have something that's evergreen instead of topical, you've got two audiences for this stuff. You've got the audience that's waiting with bated breath for the next episode. And then you've got the people that aren't maybe even born yet that are going to hear it down the road. It's very analogous to a book, right? So you could put out a book and you might serialize it in a magazine. And then each month, you know, this is probably dating us now, but then each month the listenership is eagerly awaiting the next installment in the magazine, but you're also writing for an audience that isn't going to find you for a long time. And it sort of a light bulb went on over our heads a while back where we realized that audience doesn't care how long it took you to make the production. They just care that it's good. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a showrunner the other day, and I was going over that same dilemma you said where, you know, trickle of releasing new content. And he said, "You're making absolutely the right choice," because he said, "If you screw it up and do something that's not that good," he goes, "the people that are waiting with bated breath will just go, 'Oh, that sucked,' and move on. Whereas the people down the road who've never found it, that's the real audience you need to be working for." And so once you have the luxury of not having to produce content that quickly, you know, a lot of people just need to get it out because they have an audience waiting and they need the ads or whatever it is. We're in a position right now where we can just focus on quality and figure that if you do that and it's good enough, everything else sort of takes care of itself down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're touring now, I noticed. I forget what your next cities are, but presumably everyone can find your schedule on your website. What do you do at those events? How do you structure those events?
You know, I kind of got talked into that because I wasn't sure what the attraction was. But, you know, my agents and whatnot were establishing that there was a demand out there on the part of promoters and whatnot. So we did some test shows last year. I've done like book tours and stuff like that. We did some test shows. They went really well. And so we thought about adding 4 or 6 shows a year when possible, when it doesn't, you know, decrease our already voluminous release schedule. Mm. But otherwise, yeah, just it's sort of a lark, I think. I think the audience enjoys it and I enjoy seeing them, but it's never going to be a huge part of what we do, probably.
But do you write a talk for that event?
Oh, or? I see what you're saying. No. Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to. I think maybe that provides a more predictable product for an audience showing up, because part of the attraction now is we don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I go on there usually with some friend or a colleague or something, and then we start talking in front of the audience, and then we'll take audience questions. And every right. single time we've done it, it's been completely different. So maybe there's some predictability if you have a show per se, but this isn't really a show. It's just sort of a talk.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually touring for the first time in 6 years starting next week, and I'm really
enjoying
it. I haven't started yet. This is the, we don't know yet.
Okay.
I'm enjoying preparing for it. I'm writing a talk and thought I was going to divide the event into talk and then discussion. But in writing the talk, I found that I have so much to get off my chest that I'm just going to talk the whole time and walk off stage. I'm going to feel like two hours.
Happy at the end, right? That's all we care about.
But no, I'm looking forward to it. It feels like in real life, moments are more and more precious. I mean, we've just migrated our lives to this digital swamp, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. And, you know, the one thing you can't fake, the one thing you really have to make tangible sacrifices for is to be present with people. And so it seems like it's a good thing to do, and it's been too long. So
I think there's a pendulum aspect to it, too. I think as we move into an era where it's harder and harder to tell what's real and what's not, and a lot of the content out there is artificially or computer generated, I think human beings start to seek authenticity. You know, when the pendulum swings so far in the other direction, all of a sudden maybe old-time theater comes back and you want to see people spitting on stage and unexpected lights falling from the ceiling and actors having to improv. Maybe this creates a thirst for authenticity, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into it. First, before I drag you into the morass here, remind people of your own politics. I mean, how have you? You've apart from Hardcore History, you've had your Common Sense podcast for years, where you've commented on topical issues and worried about the state of American politics for quite a bit longer than many have worried about it. And we're going to get into some of your concerns, but remind people of just how you frame your own politics for your audience.
Well, I mean, a political party of one, right? A religion of one. I mean, I really. I think, you know, when you look back on your life as you get older, as we are, you notice things that didn't really make sense when you were younger that seemed more clear to you. And one of those things for me is being a radio talk show host who didn't fit in the daytime. I mean, we used to call me the Martian in the day part, right? I mean, there'd be some conservative AM host before me and some conservative AM host after me. And the advantage now, looking back on it, that I see was I fought with that audience all the time. I mean, they didn't like me all that much a lot of the time. And I found that I learned things from them that I didn't know as a kid from Los Angeles, you know, growing up when I did. And at the same time, began to understand their arguments and concerns a little bit more. And then also at the same time, learned that I don't need to preach to a choir, right? There was not going to be any sort of audience for me anyway. So it was all about learning how to live with people who disagreed with you fundamentally about a lot of things. And so now, when you convert that from AM radio, commercial radio, into something like podcasting with Common Sense, I was primed to not have an audience that saw things my way. And if you listen to the imaging, you know, I would write the liners for the Big Voice guy. And a long time ago, I learned that when you have faults, as many as I have, you try to make lemons into lemonade. And you have the Big Voice announcer sort of turn all of your problems and downsides and weaknesses into selling points, right? And so being this guy that wasn't a Democrat or Republican that didn't agree with the way things were, we turned those from weaknesses into strengths through the branding and the marketing. What was weird, Sam, is that when I started in the 1990s, there literally was nobody on my side. But then somehow we just caught a wave accidentally in the zeitgeist, right? And so for a little while, it almost seemed like there was a new generation coming up that was more in tune with the way I thought. And it was all false hope because we fell right off the cliff later, but into a worse situation than before. But for a long time, me doing AM radio with an audience that didn't like me very much turned out to be a pretty good breeding ground, I found, in a way that I didn't realize at the time.
Hmm. So how is America doing, Dan? What's your general sense of the last, I guess a lot, but we're going to talk a fair amount about the Trump 2.0 moments of the last 7 months, but you can take a larger bite of it than that. It's been a few years since we've spoken. What's your sense of the state of our country?
Well, I think where I differ from a lot of people, and this is to be expected, I guess, given my proclivities, but I look at this in a much sort of zoom out, longer term lens. I mean, many of the things that we look at as relatively recent political developments, 10 years, 12 years, whatever you want to say, look to me like decades of dominoes tumbling to get us to where we are now. Like one of the things that I'll get slammed for by some people is that they'll say that I blame both sides for things. You know, I'm a both sidesarism kind of guy. But when you've got problems that I assert are decades and decades and decades in the making, it's not only one part of the political system that's involved in it, but by its very nature, right? And so when you ask how I see it in a much more longer term sense. A lot of what's going on now to me seems like the end result of a bunch of things we did warn about and talk about forever, along with a lot of other people. The growth in executive power and authority, the Swiss cheesing over the eras of the Constitution, the weakening of the guardrails, and all these sorts of things, until you eventually get somebody who isn't bound by protocol, which by the end of the 20th century was really the only thing holding back some president who didn't want to be bound by protocol, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, that was the shock of the first Trump administration, from my point of view, that we discovered that in the place of laws, what we really had backstopping the protocol is norms that people decided not to violate. And Trump certainly discovered that you could violate them with impunity. And the second time around, we're getting more of that, more or less as expected. All right, so let's take the larger sweep before we focus on the last 7 months. What have been your concerns going back decades about what some have called the imperial powers of the presidency?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me just say, I feel like the era, if you're looking on the bright side or if you're looking for silver linings, I feel like the era that we're living through now has helped me better understand eras in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there tends to be, the times change and you never dip your toe into the same river water twice, but you can dip your toe into the same river. And I feel like what we're seeing now helps me better understand other eras in history where you were going, what were they thinking? Or how do people behave? Because I think we sort of devolve toward the mean when we get into large groups of people in similar kinds of structures. And I feel like watching what's happening to us now unfolding, I understand the 30s better, the 40s better. I feel like, and that's something that when you live longer, you just inherently understand history better because you've lived through more of it, right? So when you talk about our problems here, it's a combination, in my opinion, of systemic and then the people, right? Because you couldn't get away with a lot of the stuff that's being done now if the American population were, for example, the same people they were 40 years ago. It's almost like the old frog in the hot water trope. I mean, we were at a different level of water heat back then, and we wouldn't have put up with it. What's so shocking to me as I watch the zeitgeist and the country unfold the way it is how many people are either good with it, things that we never would have put up with a long time ago, or the unquantifiable ability we human beings have to tell ourselves we're not seeing what's really happening. That to me is also, I find, instructive. Like I'm learning about humanity by our ability to fool ourselves into not seeing what we think we're seeing. Like we smell brimstone, we don't want to smell brimstone, so we pretend we're not smelling brimstone. That's not really an answer to your question, but I think we're in an end game here where there's some Rubicon moments happening. That doesn't mean they're going to happen, but this is the most dangerous I've felt the country's been in my lifetime. And the very things that I feel are threatening it are the very things we talked about forever. I mean, these are all things, I've been discussing these things since long before I was on the radio, listening to the dead Kennedys in 1980 talking about these things, right?
Yeah, so, well, I must say, it is cold comfort that you might be getting a better handle on the Weimar Republic or the fall of Rome living through the current instance, right? I mean,
looking for silver linings.
These are the pleasures of a historian or an amateur historian.
That's right.
And, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I view those points in history differently now. And I want to get to the psychology and sociology of it all, because I think you and I are similarly mystified as to how something like half the country can see what's happening so differently. But before we're there, just again, generically, what are the concerns about presidential power that predate the Trump administration from your point of view? I mean, do you take something like the executive order, which is being used with such abandon now, or, you know, the emergency powers, right? The ability to declare more or less anything an emergency and then do whatever he wants. You know, this obviously precedes Trump. What's your view of the history that has led up to this moment?
Well, it goes back to the founding, right? It predates the Constitution. The Articles of Confederation, we're still having these questions about the power of the executive and whether or not we need a king and how much the other branches of government should be involved in being able to checkmate what a powerful executive wants to do. I mean, Madison versus Marbury, these are all, I mean, when you study American history, this is the basic 101 level stuff, right? I mean, so nothing's new in that regard. The difference is, though, when you read, and I'm a huge fan of the founding documents, when you read things like the Federalist Papers and you realize the guys writing this are like 23, 24 years old, it's shocking, right? But when you read what they're talking about all these questions like what the role of a chief executive could be. What do you do if the chief executive is not a wise person? You know, what other elements in the country are there to play off against that, right? And what do you do if somebody goes rogue? You can find in our past presidencies, lots of examples of people pushing the presidential envelope. You mentioned earlier the term the imperial presidency. Well, that dates back from a book from the early 70s that Arthur Schlesinger wrote. Mm. And he's writing about the presidency from his era, right? The Nixonian presidency, right? Which when I grew up, that was considered to be sort of the went too far president, and we're going to learn from that, right? But the powers of the presidency now, 40 years later, are infinitely stronger than they were when we were worried about an imperial president in the early 1970s. The fact that we don't talk more about that is indicative as to the problems. I mean, if you're not going to have a conversation about what's wrong systemically with the system, well, you're certainly not going to identify the problems, and you're going to have even less public support towards fixing them. So when you say, what was the common sense show about? We had a few pillars, and one of the pillars was partisanism and hyper-partisanism and what that was going to do to us and how the system is incentivized. I mean, you know, there's a lot of money in dividing Americans from each other. But also the idea of the checks and balances in our country and how those things have been diminishing over time, and that eventually you're going to run into somebody who takes advantage of that.
Can you imagine a candidate for the presidency in 2028, say, picking as a central plank of his or her platform, curtailing the powers of the presidency?
It's counterintuitive, isn't it? It's part of the problem. It's part of why we haven't had it. So, for example, let's say you had a Democrat run and say, well, we never have to have, this can't happen again, so you elect me, I'm going to return power from the executive branch to the courts and to the Congress, and we'll fix this imbalance, right? Mm-hmm. Something we used to talk about all the time. Well, the people that raised money for that candidate, the people that elected that candidate, they're going to accuse that candidate of surrendering to the other side, of behaving in a unilateral disarmament, right? The other side pushes the envelope and then we give up. In other words, all of the carrots and sticks in our system are designed to run with any constitutional imbalances caused by the previous party and the previous occupant of the White House. So you're right. It's absolutely counterintuitive to think about somebody gaining power with all that that requires and then turning around and giving it away, because that's what the system needs.
Yeah. I mean, it would be, I guess I could be an audience of one here, but it would be a very attractive thing to run on from my point of view, because I, you know, obviously I have many concerns about what Trump is doing and intends to do, but I have similar concerns if anyone too far to the left took instruction from his example and we had a president AOC or someone like that who just decided to declare a state of emergency left, right, and center and issue executive orders like we've been seeing.
Well, it's political hypocrisy, isn't it? Right? If the other side did it, what would people be saying? And you had mentioned executive orders earlier. I throw signing statements in with those too. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way those things used to be used, so people will say something like, well, you know, they've been using executive orders and signing statements forever. Yes, but not for the same thing, right? So for example, when George W. Bush started issuing signing statements to bills that he disagreed with, but he wanted to pass for political reasons, what he essentially did was say, I'm signing this bill, the signing statement would say, I'm signing this bill, but I'm not being bound by anything that I feel later interferes with the, you know, actual powers of the presidency. In other words, it was like putting an asterisk next to your signature. Mm-hmm. And you can say something like, well, past presidents used signing statements, and they absolutely did, but they didn't use them like that, right? So it's a little bit like executive orders now. We don't use them the way we used to. And when they used to be rare, it was one thing. So one of the things I'll hear Trump supporters say is that Donald Trump isn't doing anything that other presidents haven't done. But let me make a distinction. So let's say you take the most constitutionally extreme thing that Bill Clinton ever did and add it to the most constitutionally extreme thing Ronald Reagan ever did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you get a president in the future who does all those things, right? In other words, I'm not doing anything Ronald Reagan didn't do or Bill Clinton, but I am doing what both of them did. In other words, there's a quantity has a quality all its own standard there also.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the current president is doing things that have been done before, but not by one president. So, I mean, we are changing the nature of things that way.
Yeah, I mean, he's also doing things, I mean, in defense of our mutual incredulity at this point about the mental states of our neighbors, he's also doing things that no president has done before. And these are things that, I mean, the one that sticks in my memory now and was remarkable for the fact that it was so quickly memory-holed by the media is that, I think about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, both Trump and his director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, accused President Obama of treason, right? And treason is at least potentially punishable by death, right? So we have a sitting president and his director of national intelligence claiming that a former president is guilty of a crime that may carry the death penalty. And that lasted in our public conversation for about, I don't know, 90 minutes before something else took its place. I mean, it just seems to me we're in a very different spot culturally around politics and partisanship and just what is, I mean, I don't even know how to think about it seeming normal for a president to behave that way.
Well, he behaves like a right-wing talk show host, right? So he essentially does, you know, people will, anytime you say something like, well, presidents have never divided Americans like this guy, they'll say something like, well, what about Hillary Clinton, who wasn't a president, with her basket of deplorables comments and all these. Once again, we're picking really unusual situations to make a point about a guy who does this every day, right. Every day.
Every hour of every day.
Yes, we have my supporters and we have the bad Americans. Okay, well, this is, so when people say, what is he doing that no one's ever done? That's what he's doing that no one's ever done, right? You used to be a president for all Americans. And if you called some Americans out, well, that happened occasionally, but this is a divide and conquer strategy. I mean, this is literally what I've been complaining that talk radio and the media has been doing for 30 years, where we're turning up the heat because heat equals, look, they used to say in radio, I'd get off the air and I'd get into a fight daily with the program director or the station consultant, they'd be screaming at me that they want more heat. That was the word in the 90s, heat.
Mm.
Well, heat just means arguments, making up disagreements so that people stay engaged through the commercial break. In other words, there's a lot, we've talked about this, there's a lot of money in what's going on now, this dividing Americans. And what Trump has done is taken something that used to be a shtick for an industry. And he comes from that industry, kind of, and then uses it in a political sense. And it is just as toxic, but also just as effective when he uses it on the world stage the way he is, as it is when a guy like Sean Hannity does it.
Hmm. Except it's not just a shtick in the same, or it's hard to know what the,
yes, the
what, where the boundary.
Shtick? Yes, where's the line? No, you're going right there. Where's the line between the shtick and the policy? Exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, it has world historical consequences. I mean, if it's just shtick when he's got Zelensky in the Oval Office and he's browbeating him, you know, for being ungrateful and for having started a war with Russia, it's, you know, there's a war raging and peace not being accomplished. And he's taking the side of the dictator who started the war. And if it's all just shtick, still it's shtick that's being paid for in the blood of innocent people.
Take it farther than that. I mean, people don't pay attention to this because we've lived with it for so long, we've internalized it. But this man, as Richard Nixon said near the end of his presidency, has the power to go back in the other room and order the deaths of 1 billion or 2 billion people.
Mm.
Nobody's had that power in human history until relatively recently.
Yeah.
And we still haven't gotten our minds around the obvious limitations of a human being's ability to handle power like that. And then you throw somebody who I wouldn't put the words wisdom and that man in the same sentence, and yet he's got control over nuclear weapons. And if you say something to me like, well, better him than, you know, fill in the blank, Okay, but what prevents the fill-in-the-blank person from getting that job? We've not wrestled with the implications of what this means. This guy can launch nuclear weapons. He doesn't have to ask anybody's permission, okay? Is that really somebody you would trust with that? And let's assume you would trust him 10 years ago with that. Would you trust him 10 years from now? I mean, when do we reach the point where somebody like a Joe Biden, who you maybe would have trusted at 45, you won't trust at 75, right?
All right, so Trump has been busy for the last 7 months, and it remains to be seen whether everything or really anything he's done is legal. I mean, there are hundreds of court cases now pending, pushing back against his executive orders. He's deployed troops to American streets. He's incarcerated people without due process. He's imposed tariffs on every country on earth. He's gutted consumer protections. There's been this really senseless crippling of American science and cutting budgets for the NSF and other scientific orgs, funding orgs. He's purged military leaders for political purposes. He's unleashed the Justice Department on his critics. Coming back to the point you made pretty much at the outset here, how do you understand the phenomenon that greets us every time we look at our computers or turn on a television set, that intelligent people, I mean, something like half the country, view this as more or less a state of nothing much happening? It's either desirable or it's just, you know, utterly anodyne in that it's, you know, there's nothing remarkable happening here. How do you interpret that sense of normalcy?
Well, it's the part that's more disturbing than any part connected to Trump personally, because he's not going to be our problem for 30 years, right? I mean, he's going to go away. But whatever he's tapped into or whatever he's a function of on the part of our electorate and our population, that's not going away. And it's why when people ask me to be more critical of his supporters and whatnot, I try to divide them into the people that you can still reach and the people you can't. Because a lot of people are problem people, and then other people are solution people. It just depends on your personality type. We need everybody, right? And the way my brain looks is, how do you get yourself out of this mess? And the way to get ourselves out of this mess never is about Trump. It's always about the electorate and trying to figure out if this is something that is correctable or not correctable. And I don't know what the problem is. I remember growing up and, you know, being a history guy, you always heard that, oh, if we don't teach civics and history in school, you know, where will that lead 20 or 30 years down the road? I talk to people who do similar things and have similar backgrounds to myself who'll bring that up, like maybe we've lost something by not letting people know what is American so they can recognize it when it's being violated. I don't know. Not enough data, right? But I can say that to me, the problem is the electorate or just these people. You know, I wish, and it's an old line, you wish you could just give every American some travel money and say, go around the world and travel to some other countries and just get a larger sample size of how they function. Because a country like ours, which is a superpower, is unlike most countries, right? We live in a sort of a different rarefied reality than most other countries. But when you go to other countries, and they have their political fights just like we do, and they have their division. I mean, they're human beings, right? But there's so much that's working fine, and their people are still getting along. And in other words, there's a normalcy. You use the word normalcy, which is a great inner World War term, right? When we just wanted to get back to normalcy after the First World War. I would love to get back to some level of normalcy now. And my fear is that that's gone, that is itself. It's like you're in the Roman Republic during Caesar's years, and you're just wishing for the days when we all got along. Well, can the Roman Republic be turned around in 60 BCE? I don't know, but that's where I feel we are today. We're either on a slope that's a one-way trip further downhill, or, you know, we mentioned Nixon earlier, and after the Nixon years, there was a wonderful period of reform, which was the pendulum swinging back, right? Nixon exposed certain problems in our system. The Congress actually spent the 1970s after Nixon left office trying to fix that. You had the Church Committee hearings, the Pike Committee hearings, all these kinds of things. Much of what we know about the CIA came out from those hearings because we were talking about, you know, what Nixon was doing with the CIA and it all. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of times in American history, you don't get reform without violations that prompt reform. So when I'm in one of my up moods and I'm looking for silver linings, I look at this and say, okay, when Trump is gone, there's either going to have to be some repair of our system and the electorate to say, oh gosh, we don't want to go there again, so what can we do? Or we're just going to have to sort of reconcile ourselves to being in the Roman Republic in 60 BCE. And as my old liner guy, Bill Barrett, used to say, enjoy the ride straight downhill, because, you know, those are your options.
Well, so we're obviously talking about different cohorts here, because there are the people who think that fundamentally nothing is going on, right? There's nothing truly out of the ordinary is happening. And if you point to a specific thing that strikes you as especially egregious and would have been unthinkable in any year in the past, I mean, say, take Trump and his family inventing a meme coin, which is a mechanism by which they can be paid bribes by, you know, every foreign agent on earth or, you know, domestic agent, and they've already reaped something at a minimum hundreds of millions, probably into the billions of dollars now. That seems just obviously corrupt. It should be illegal. It should be, it should be unthinkable. But you express those concerns in the wrong direction, and what you get back is something like, well, it's nothing out of the ordinary is happening here because, you know, Nancy Pelosi has, you look at her stock portfolio, she's clearly made some trades that have been, improbably advantageous to her and her family. So there's, you know, all politicians are corrupt. You know, there is no difference in scale. There's no difference in the real world effects of this corruption. And it's just, you know, both sides do it, right? That's an example of, or you might point to his, you know, Trump's, you know, from the last administration, something like 30,000 documented lies, right? You talk about the avalanche of lies that has come out of him, and you'll get some instance of, Obama said that you'd be able to keep your doctor if, when Obamacare was instituted. He lied about that. So, you know, all accounts here are equal. So there's this problem of kind of false equivalency. But then there are the people who understand exactly what's happening. I mean, they would probably see many of these events the same way we do in terms of their novelty. But the moral valence is flipped. They think this is what should be happening. You know, their side is winning. This is how you have to win. This is how they want to win. They admire people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, or, you know, people who really just seize the reins of power for the right reasons, whatever those reasons are, keep the immigrants out, et cetera, bring back, good Christian values. These are fundamentally two different groups of people. So let's just take them systematically. To what do you attribute the views of the people who think not much is happening? And then let's talk about the people who know that a whole hell of a lot is happening and they think it's all to the good.
Yeah, I want to lock them in a room together, because one of the main critiques I get, and I'll get after this conversation we're having today is released, is that I have Trump derangement syndrome, that I only call out one side, which is ludicrous because my whole career has been about calling out all sides, but that's okay. I only call out, I've got Trump derangement syndrome, and I'm just imagining all this stuff. But what I want to do is lock them into a room with one of these Project 2024-5 guys. I want them to be, in other words, I want them to be in a room with these people from the right who see what we're talking about and are in favor of it, right? They want a Viktor Orban. In other words, I'm hearing from those people, this is exactly what I voted for, and this is what I want. At the same time, I'm hearing from their brethren, who are also Trump supporters, telling me I'm imagining the whole thing and it's a liberal plot. Okay, talk to your own people. I mean, there are websites out there written by guys who are connected to things like the Claremont Institute and the Heritage Foundation that are around the president right now, that you can go search the term Red Caesar if you want to. Red Caesar is a wonderful term, because what it is it's a right-wing idea that the country's already doomed, or that it fell apart sometime in the past, last 10, 20 years. So talking about treason when you want a dictator is a moot point, because the United States that you would be treasonous against is gone. I hope I'm not putting words into the mouth of this person. You can go read the website and their own description of a Red Caesar. But their point is that autocracy's here, and we're arguing about whether it should be a red/Republican autocracy or a blue/Democratic autocracy. This question about going back to a constitutional republic in their minds is a moot point. If you think I have TDS for saying that I'm worried about autocracy, go talk to those people, because they're on your side. And if they don't have Trump derangement syndrome, well, then what do they have? In other words, part of this, and you mentioned it yourself, is trying to deal with this on a realistic basis rather than argue about what's going on. It's why we can't have good arguments anymore, Sam, because they never get below the, well, where did you get your information point of the argument? And that's the first thing anybody says. We can argue about whether or not it was good to have a shared reality back in, say, the 1980s, when you could have arguments over the water cooler and somebody would say, well, I got that information from the New York Times. And that would be good for 92% of the people in the room. Now, is the New York Times selling propaganda or lying too? They have. So I don't know why that should be our shared reality, but there's something to be said for having one. Because when the shared reality goes away, well, any sort of in-depth conversations become impossible because we don't live in the same world. We don't live in the same reality. So conversations have no meeting point where we get to the meeting of the minds, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So to what do you attribute our current state? I mean, is the onus on the information landscape mostly, the shattering that we've witnessed due to both the internet and obviously social media and smartphones in the last 15, 20 years?
Well, I think it's bigger than that. Let's zoom out, because that's huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, I compare our entire generation now to the kids growing up today are a guinea pig generation, because not only do we not know what the current technology will do to them, by the time we start to figure out how to live with MySpace, there will be a Facebook. By the time we learn how to live with Facebook, there'll be an iPhone. In other words, we never get the chance to, like, you know, the way 2,000 years ago society could deal with the invention of a new plow, right? Or movable print. I mean, we never get that chance then to sort of adjust to the new reality. But I would suggest that what's going on there when you zoom out is that we're seeing sort of the results of a digital world, which is the one we live in now, putting an extreme stress on a bunch of systems created in an analog era. And I mean things that you don't normally think of in that vein. I mean, what if something like a nation state, right, which are traditionally dated to the Peace of Westphalia in the 1600s, but probably date before that. But let's imagine a nation state. That's an analog system. Can a nation state, when controlling information used to be a huge part of what a nation state did, I mean, remember how dangerous people thought radio-free Europe was? A single radio signal going over the Iron Curtain is going to destroy the Soviet Union? But that shows you how something like controlling information was a key part of an analog system like a nation state. Can a nation state and other analog systems like that deal with the challenges of a digital world? I remember interviewing science historian James Burke that felt that it couldn't. And his attitude was, you're going to have countries go away, and they're going to be replaced by like-minded groups who may not be geographically located near each other at all, but who share attitudes and views and whatnot, rather than language, culture, borders, geography, and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, take it even farther, Sam. The question is the very structure of our reality able to handle the challenges of the things like our modern technology? And if it can handle, you know, today's modern technology, can it handle what's coming down the pike?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a major concern around AI. I mean, now we've...
Absolutely. Or yeah, let me throw it, I don't mean to interrupt you. It's not only a major concern, I'm starting to wish for AI to solve our problems and the aliens to show up, because I'm running out of other good ways to solve these things.
Right.
A little alien tech.
Yeah, well, so I mean, the fragmentation you're imagining is obviously already here, and it's being layered on top of the existing nation state structures, right? The nation state still exists.
Rather than dig out the earth and start, we're layering it on top of, and it's creating deformities like a brittle telephone system. Yeah.
So what specifically worries you in the near term in American politics? How concerned are you? Let's take the piece of the far right, whatever that means. Again, it's a coalition that doesn't necessarily all agree with itself. You know, you go far enough to the right, you definitely meet what we call white supremacists and ethno-nationalists and Christian identitarians and anti-Semites, et cetera. But, you know, obviously adjacent to that, you have people who, you have the current presidency, right? You know, like all the convictions I just named don't necessarily exist in the brain of Trump or even his, you know, most of his advisors, although the, you know, many of his fans would answer to some of those names. How do you view the right wing of American politics at this moment?
Well, my viewpoint was always that I wanted to be left alone to pursue happiness, right? Whatever that meant. And you too. I mean, I always felt like life is difficult. I have it easy compared to, I mean, look around the world, right? I have it easy and I find life difficult. So what does the poor kid in India on the garbage pile think his life is like, right? So life is historically difficult for the best of us, right? In terms of those of us who are most blessed.
Yeah.
So I always feel like in as tough a society and life, I just want the ability then to craft as much as I can some sort of happiness out of a life for myself, my family, my community, and all those kinds of things. People telling me what I can't and can't do in order to do that have always rubbed me the wrong way. And those people don't have a side of the political spectrum. They can be left, they can be right, they can just be busybodies or religious people that want to control what I do. And so I've always reacted less with left and right than just hands off, right? I'm having enough trouble getting through this life and being happy just like the rest of us are. Let's leave it one another alone. So that obviously—
Have you ever called yourself a libertarian? Has that ever been an explicit—
The problem is, so here's the libertarian thing. It's the only party I've actually ever given money to. But the problem with the libertarians, as any libertarian knows, is that they're all individuals. Good luck coming up with a platform, right? And my problem with libertarianism has always been the economics of it. I'm not an economic libertarian. Mm-hmm. I don't think taxes are theft. Right. I think that society requires taxes to run. Now, I don't want the money spent poorly, right? I don't want to get 10 cents out of every dollar in terms of results for my spending. So I'm fiscally conservative in that regard. But I'm not a libertarian economically. I am a civil libertarian, though, in terms of rights and freedoms and the things that your Constitution protects.
Right. I mean, I guess, so there are many people you can find, if my YouTube algorithm is any judge, you can find people who are openly worrying about the possibility of civil war in America, right? And I think it's misleading when we have this phrase civil war and we think, you know, our nearest reference point is our own civil war, wherein, you know, opposing armies are arrayed on a field, you know, one half of the country fighting the other half of the country. And that's not, I think, any sane person's expectation of the possibility of civil war in the 21st century, certainly not in America or in most places. But many people are worried about the possibility of our hyper-partisanship becoming considerably more dystopian than it is at the moment, which is to say, you know, violent. Does that just seem paranoid to you at this point, or does that seem like the kind of thing one should be mindful of in the year 2025?
Well, the reason that we can't have a civil war the way we had it in the 1860s is because we're not so wonderfully geographically divided like then. I mean, we're divided by precincts and urban areas versus rural areas. It'd be a lot harder to have. But this country and a lot of other countries have gone through unstable periods with political extremism that manifests itself differently. I mean, look at the late 60s and early 70s in this country. If I told you how many bomb threats the United States was dealing with every single day in that era, it's funny how we've forgotten about it, to be honest. But a history person, I think, somebody whose mind works that way as opposed to math or something like that, I think we look at those things to try to find a baseline for normality, right? So if you look at something like that and say, well, at least we're not having 750 bomb threats every day or whatever it was. But I think that, to your point, that is how you can have, if not a civil war, then a breakdown in your societal norms and standards and the stress level, right? When bombs start going off and people start dying, you obviously take things to another level, right? And those are still in front of us to be had, if you will. Although, let's remember, I was on the air. I remember doing the tease with Ralph Steadman here in this town where I am right now, the morning of the Oklahoma City bombing. I think we'd be silly if we didn't see that somewhere on the continuum of what we're seeing now, right? A decades earlier version of it, but some of those people were just a little farther along on the anger spectrum at that time than most of us were. And a guy like Timothy McVeigh might be a whole lot, with the Overton window where it is now, a whole lot more normal with online communities and whatnot than he was in the middle 1990s.
Yeah, so, but to that point, why would the far right be angry now? I mean, it's getting virtually everything it wants, right? Wouldn't you expect the last 7 months, the fairly triumphal last 7 months of Trumpism, to have just let the pressure out of that balloon?
It depends. See, but I think the mistake that we make when we do this is assuming ever, not just with Trump's audience, but any audience, that they're all a unified block. It's like I mentioned earlier, locking the Heritage Foundation people with the in the same room, right? So, I mean, I think you've got different people. The people that are really behind, and look, we could talk about the left-wing extremism too, which we don't have a lot of right now in terms of manifesting, but that happens too. But at the right-wing extremism, there's a whole bunch of people. I mean, go read online what they write. I mean, there's people that want to go so far towards returning us to a country like something from a 1950s Palmolive ad or something that a lot of Trump supporters wouldn't go for. So, you know, all of these political movements are made up of people all along the spectrum. But Trump's most right-wing, autocratic supporting Viktor Orban types, I mean, they're writing on, you can go read their stuff online. They want like a Viktor Orban type thing or a Putin thing. It's why there's so much. I mean, listen, if you want to know where I've been wrong, we've talked a little bit about where I've been right, but let me tell you where I've been wrong, Sam, over the years. I really believed, and I've admitted these things, I admitted it at Stanford during a conversation. I really thought things like racism was waning. I really thought growing up that, you know, the Archie Bunker mentality that we grew up with and All in the Family was going to die out, that these people, you couldn't change them, but they were temporary, right? They were relics of another age. And I remember having the conversation at Stanford with somebody who brought this up, and I flashed back to a conversation I had as a news reporter with a Croatian expatriate here in Eugene. It was during the collapse of the Yugoslavian nation state into violence. And, you know, that's an area that had traditionally extremely age-old hatreds amongst various people, Serbs, Croats, Bosnian Muslims, people, Albanians. And so in order to localize this story, I found this expatriate, a Croatian guy, and we were talking about what was going on in Yugoslavia. And he had this great line that I flashed back to. He said, "We were all getting along fine." He says, "Don't talk to me about 14th century battles and stuff where we hated each other." He goes, "We were having these wonderful romances between Serb guys and Croatian girls and romance stories." He goes, "But what happened was the economic situation turned sour." He goes, "And then the demagogues appeared. And what the demagogues do is they blame the traditional adversaries, right? The people, and they're the problem. And they're why you don't have enough money. And they're why you're not doing better." And in other words, they just found wonderful ways to slip the chisel into the cracks that society had been plastering over. Or he described it like, he said, a fire that had gone almost out. And you think the fire's out, but all it takes is a demagogue to throw the gasoline on those glowing coals, and boom, it's like it never left. And that's where I was wrong. I thought we were making one way, do not back up or you shred your tires on the spikes kind of racial progress. And instead, it was more like a fire that had just died down and was just waiting for somebody to remind us how much we hate those people who don't look like us.
I think I actually see that variable a little differently. I think I'm not seeing the signs that our gains on race and racism have been forfeited. I mean, first, a lot of support
for
Trump.
You don't think it's worse now than it was in, say, 1995?
Well, it's hard to know based on sheer numbers. So obviously, there's some very voluble racists out there, and we hear more of them because of social media and also what...
Yeah. Well, you know, there's no gatekeepers,
what
right?
Elon
you couldn't
has
say
done
that on the radio back in the day, right? You'd be fired.
Yeah. But, I mean, just when you look at, you take something like support for interracial marriage back in the 50s, that was at 5% in America.
Illegal in a bunch of states, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's 2021, there's 94% support for it in America, right? So, I mean, swinging from 5% to 94%, that's, you know, if the fire isn't totally out, it's pretty close to out right now. I'll grant you, you know, some massive economic shock or something else that could derange our society. But I mean, even a lot of the support for Trump has been interracial, right? It's not, I mean, it's certainly the gains he made, you know, the much trumpeted gains he made in the second time around came surprisingly from Latino immigrants and Latino citizens and the Black community, right? I mean, it's not that most Black women voted for him, but a surprising number did, or certainly a surprising number of Black men did. So I don't think his rise is, you know, I mean, it's a mixed picture, because I think he clearly has pandered to whatever racists are out there whose vote he counted on, right? I mean, there is a dog whistling phenomenon or just a failure to condemn odious commitments clearly, right? I remember the time when he was asked to disavow the support of David Duke, and he pretended not to know who David Duke was when it was clearly obvious that he knew exactly who David Duke was. Trump is guilty of the sin of never disavowing the support of even the worst human beings on earth because he's such a narcissist. Anyone who supports him can't be all bad. But I would be surprised if we returned to the era where there was not considerable public shame to be heaped upon somebody who was unselfconsciously racist.
I'd like to know, and this is something I've talked about before, because it's an unknowable thing. You have to read a history book from 100 or 200 years from now. I would love to know how much of the divisiveness in our society is actually part of a plan by people who do not wish the United States well to deliberately create the fissures in our society and make them larger. I mean, for example, if we found out in 100 years that this was all that we had, because we know we do, we have paid members of intelligence services from foreign countries going and writing on the comment section after news stories or posting on Reddit or, in other words,
right.
There are people out there that work for countries, and we may be doing this to other people too. I never take the United States out of the picture because we all, countries act in certain ways. But tearing apart our country from within, if that turned out to be, for lack of a better word, let's use a term that was big when we were kids, if that was a commie plot and they were deliberately turning Americans against one another like Bugs Bunny making a fight happen between Elmer Fudd and Daffy Duck by whispering into each other's ears, that would be the greatest intelligence coup in world history if that happened. So I often think about that and just go, I wonder how much of the temperature in our society right now is artificially created by people who are hoping that it will hurt the United States. And there's no way to know that.
Well, there's no question that there's some of it. I mean, some of it has been demonstrated, but the fissures need to be there to be exploited, right? Like, who's going to be susceptible to the comment that says, this is a Jewish plot, or, you pick your conspiracy theory.
Well, given history, Sam, lots of people.
Exactly, yeah. So the problem is we have this ambient level of conspiracy thinking and tribalism.
We should point out that the powers that be have played their role in this too. You lie to us about what's going on long enough, and you create a situation where nobody believes anything, and the only people that can shut down these rumors is the boy who cried wolf, right? The government that lied to us about it. So you create a situation where nothing is believable anymore, and we choose our own realities, and we're surprised that we all live in our own different bubbles right now. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
But it's the proportion thing that still mystifies me, right? So you can find a documented lie or just a flagrant error, and that you have, many people, now this is still right of center, many people right of center will point to something that was said or misstated during COVID, say, and that is the thing that radicalized them. And so now they're willing to believe Alex Jones's account of reality because what? Because Biden said that the vaccines would stop transmission, right? Because for 15 minutes, the scientific community had a consensus that they would stop transmission until we got more data in, right? So it's like the idea that this one glib, the asymmetry here is that that every time the New York Times gets something wrong, it basically destroys the brand for all time for half the country. Whereas, you have other outlets like Fox News or Breitbart or, the One America News Network, which don't even pretend to hold themselves to journalistic standards, right? And yet that's where you'll get your news, right? You can't trust the CDC anymore, but you can trust RFK Jr. now. It's just, again, it loses all sense of proportion.
Well, I mean, yes, I get that. In other words, once we stop believing the authorities, then we're open game for anybody out there who might have some crackpot theory to throw at us.
But also the thing that caused you to stop believing the authorities was only salient against a background of, journalistic or academic or governmental propriety that you felt you could take for granted and found that you couldn't in that one instance, right? And so
let's make a distinction because you bring up a good point. And the distinction would be thus. The distinction is straight up lies by the government that they know are lies that they just don't want you to know because you'll stop it, right?
Mm.
That's, for example, are you supporting death squads in Latin America in the 1980s, United States? No, we're not supporting deaths. So that's one kind of lie. The other kind is something that I'm much more forgiving of, which is, and I always use the George W. Bush 9/11 example, but the COVID one is another good one. There are black swan events. There are things out there that while you may get tons of warnings about, it's possible somebody will fly planes into buildings. Certain things are hard to believe till they happen.
Yep.
And I cut people slack in those situations. Now, if George W. Bush gets hit with another plane running into another building the next year, he doesn't get any slack, right? But when you're confronted with things that the likelihood is you're going to misjudge it, you're going to probably have fits and starts in how you handle it. And COVID's another example of that. And what I always say to people who say, we were forced to wear masks, we were forced to quarantine, I always say, what do you think people did during pandemics, right? Mm. I mean, when America was great, in air quotes, we had the Spanish flu in 1918, 1990. Go look at what people had to do in response to that. My God, go look at Typhoid Mary, who wouldn't stay in her room. She kept spreading typhus. So what did they do? They locked her in her room for decades, for the rest of her life. Again, this is when America was great. So this idea that the COVID thing was a complete tyrannical thing. Look, we might have made errors. They might have done things wrong. It's the same thing that George W. Bush did after 9/11. They made screw-ups, absolutely. But you cut them some slack because nobody... Look, I talked about a COVID happening in the book that I published. It happened 4 months after I published it. That was just dumb luck. But what it was meant to show is that if an idiot with no, you know, virology, you know, training at all can see that coming, well, anybody can. But it's one thing to say, there's a big virus in our future. It's another thing to say, oh my God, it's COVID, it's here, it's killing people now, what do we do? Now, if we have another outbreak like COVID in 2 years, well, to me, that's like George W. Bush getting hit with another plane hitting a building the next year. We have a responsibility to do better next time. But when people say the government's so out of control, the natural historian way of looking at this, which I'm not, is to say, well, what have we done in other like-minded situations? And if it seems beyond the pale based on that, well, maybe that's something to go on. But how do people think they handle pandemics?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're learning. Not especially
well. Well, again, and we should know better next time, yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's hard to imagine that if next time is tomorrow, it's hard to imagine we're poised for success, given the people in charge and their views.
And you know, there's a professor of mine would say, then that's the pendulum, right? I mean, if we handle it unbelievably horribly, well, maybe we learn from that. Maybe we don't. I mean, it's the old put your hand on the hot stove thing. I mean, is that what it takes for people to learn? And that's why nuclear weapons and things like that mess with me so badly, because that's a touch the hot stove once kind of deal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So certain problems bother me more than others. But I mean, just look at what's going on in Africa right now and imagine something like Ebola or another hemorrhagic fever taking hold here. It's absolutely terrifying.
So how much do you blame the left for Trump and Trumpism? I mean, we've focused a lot on the right here, but obviously there's a dialectic here. There's a yin and the yang of it
all. It's a Newtonian. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah. How much? I mean, I find perhaps to the consternation of many listeners left of center, I find that the left in recent years has been a kind of super stimulus for me and for many others, where its indiscretions have almost been more galling than Trump and Trumpism, if for no other reason than, in my view, they're largely the reason why we are susceptible to Trump and Trumpism. How do you view the left of center in our politics?
Let's make a distinction between a left of center and a Democrat, or a right of center and a Republican, because I think the two parties are different animals altogether. If we're talking about the Democratic Party, I think the Democratic Party sometimes forgets that their job is to win elections, which is what the job of a party is. You know, there was a great line that the old humorist, escaped me. He said, I'm not a member of any particular party. He said, I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat. And it was a classic line. Will Rogers, sorry. But the point is that the Democrats have always been like that. I lived through the 1980s when their presidential candidates were Walter Mondale and Michael Dukakis. And if you're looking at the country, you just go, you're asking to lose elections, okay, with those kinds of candidates. It's a little like in the 90s when you've got guys like, you know, Bob Dole is your candidate for the Republicans. I mean, you look at these people and you go, why do Americans never have two heavy hitters ever going against each other? But the parties are different than when you say left-leaning people or right-leaning people, because now we're talking about people that are not served by the parties. I mean, if you're a communist or you're a democratic socialist, a real democratic socialist, the parties aren't serving you. And to critique the Democratic Party is different than critiquing you and vice versa. So when you say, how is the left letting us down? I think both the left and the right, when you get to the far wings, they're trying to remake society, right? They're trying to remake society the way that the right wants to go back to a romantic golden age that never was, which is the classic right way to go. The left wants to go into some new, exciting, brave future that's never existed before. So, I mean, we're still dealing with utopianists on both sides. Those aren't the people that I ever speak to because they live in their own version of reality and they seek something I don't want. I'm seeking to keep what we have because I don't think we're going to get a better deal than what we have. So when people say, you know, why do you support a constitution that's all messed up like ours is? Because I don't think you're going to get a better deal than that. You remember, a constitution is nothing but a contract between a bunch of states. And that contract had all these protections for all sorts of rights and freedoms that you'll never get again. And even though they're Swiss cheese to all hell, I mean, go look at the Fourth Amendment, Swiss cheese to all hell. I would rather use the Constitution as sort of a benchmark from which to begin repairing that than to throw it out with some sort of revolution and hope that the next thing you negotiate and hammer out will be that good for our rights as that utopian in its own way 1787 document.
But take a specific issue. I mean, really, probably the greatest issue that accounts for Trump's second term, immigration. And you look at how the Democrats and the far left activists who kind of bent them around treated that issue for years. It is kind of mystifying to me that we got to a place where the chaos at the southern border went unacknowledged year after year, and anyone who did acknowledge it was castigated as a racist, left of center. I mean, that was sort of the center of moral gravity, at least for a while in Democratic politics. I don't know how any sane people who cared about their political futures got us there or got themselves there. And I mean, it was, you know, the Biden administration at the last possible moment seemed to understand that this was a politically important variable and, you know, tried to pass legislation, which Trump, you know, cynically blocked because he wanted to be able to run on the problem at the southern border, understandably. But I just, again, it strains my sanity to just try to account for how wrong the Democrats got that issue. And there's other issues. We could talk about crime and policing, you know, abolish the police. That was, you know, arguably the worst political slogan.
Those are shoot yourself in your foot policies.
Yeah, shoot yourself in your face policies. I mean, how do you understand that? I mean, to just take immigration, it was so obvious that, I mean, whatever your views are on the moral necessity of bringing, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees into the country every year, say, I mean, even if you agree that is an important thing that we want to do as a society, I mean, we can obviously debate that, but let's say that was a priority for you. You still want a border. You still want to know who's coming into the country. I've never heard an argument for an open and unenforceable border in this age of, you know, terrorism and shocking inequalities the world over, apart from a frankly utopian and fairly masochistic claim that, listen, nation states and borders are artifices that can't be mapped onto any ethical, moral landscape. No one can account for the fact that they were born in California versus, you know, in the middle of the Syrian civil war or Congo, and you have no right to the place you were born in. So we should have open borders. I mean, leave that for a philosophy seminar. In terms of practical political reality, I just don't understand how anyone thought that a concern about hundreds of thousands or even millions of people coming across the border and us having no idea who they are was racist.
But whoever, I'm going to devil's advocate here, which political candidate was saying that?
Well, I'd have to rack my brain to know who actually said it, but it was certainly said in left-wing Democratic circles, and that was considered to be a third rail you didn't want to touch. I mean, I think I bet you can find footage of Kamala Harris when she wasn't saying she was in favor of taxpayer-funded gender reassignment surgeries for illegal immigrants, incarcerated illegal immigrants. She may well have said that a concern about the southern border is racist, right? I mean,
let me turn this around. And rather than focus on the issue du jour, right? So you cited immigration. We'll play with that for a minute. I want to focus on the leadership, because I feel like you can plug any issue in for immigration you want there. And my stepdad used to say leadership is the only answer to every problem. He says, because a leader then will solve each individual problem that comes onto their desk individually with the best answer that they can come up with at the time. So let's take a great communicator, because I find that it makes a great difference. So you have a Kennedy, a John F. Kennedy, or you have a Reagan, or you have a Clinton and Obama were both great communicators. Yep. If they're standing up on the stage and somebody brings up the immigration issue, they're going to answer that well, and they're going to do a good job, and they're going to understand, because these guys do not get to where they are politically without having a pretty good finger on the pulse of the way people think, right? That's their main quality other than fundraising. To me, the problem that you're pointing out to in the Democrats wasn't the way they handled immigration. It was the kind of leaders they put forward as their candidates. First of all, some of us didn't think Joe Biden was a good leader when he was a young man, right? To me, that's the status quo in and of itself right there. But certainly, somewhere along the line, and it's a very hard question, right? It's like asking it about Trump. One day you're okay, and the next day you shouldn't have your finger on the nuclear button, and how the heck did we ever figure where that line is? But I would not have called Joe Biden a good candidate, and the fact that he'd lost several times out in the presidency, I think would have shown that. Kamala Harris is an even worse candidate, and that's nothing to say about her ethnic background, the fact that she's a woman. These are just weak. These are Dukakis and Mondale candidates. These are Dole and McCain candidates. Yeah. So when you say, immigration, this or that, change the candidate, and that issue goes away, because they'll handle it better. So to me, that these are facets of poor levels of political leadership. And it doesn't matter whether they're Democratic or Republican. These are not people that should be running for the highest office in the land. And one can make that critique over decades.
What about moving from America for a moment? What about Western Europe? Have you been paying attention to the struggles in the UK of late? I mean, there's some.
Well, as best as a non-resident can. I have a kid going to school over there, so I end up over there pretty often.
I mean, have you seen the insane abridgments of freedom of speech, an amendment for which they do not have? I mean, people have been thrown in jail for what they've posted on social media.
Well, I look at that differently than you do, because I guess, because my attitude is, and this is why I talk about the Constitution all the time, and I'm so geared toward trying to preserve what we have left of it. It's a unique document, and a lot of these other countries don't have that. So when we say, oh my gosh, they have this, and again, I think that's overblown. I'm not in a position to speak intelligently on it, but let's just say it's not. Okay, but they have a different system than we do, and this might not be something that's guaranteed. It's for them to argue about. So I don't worry. Now, if we want to talk about global trends and the fact that this idea of autocracy is a growing international trend right now, and it's on the upswing, and we've had eras like that before. I mean, in the 30s and 40s, they were talking about whether democracies had its day. So, I mean, that, again, maybe that's just cyclical. But in this case, I would just say that they don't have these rights necessarily enshrined in their constitution. So it's up to the people in the UK to decide if this is something that they want to live with or not. I will say that unlike us, in a place like the UK, that government can face a vote of no confidence and be gone tomorrow, whereas we're stuck with it for 4 years no matter what we do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the commitment to democracy is certainly waning globally. I think we have the lowest proportion of people living under liberal democracy now than at any point since 1978, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, something like 72% of the people on Earth live under autocracy, and we're kind of sliding in the wrong direction. And that slide actually started more or less the same year we got the capacity to retweet each other's posts. I think it's dated around 2009, 2010.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to believe that the rise of social media and the waning of commitment to democracy are not somehow more than correlated.
And this gets us back to something we talked about, the difference between an analog system and a digital world. I mean, some of this stuff I think you could suggest is connected to the fact that, look, there was a guy, I'm not going to say his name, but when I was a kid in Los Angeles, you probably saw these same flyers because we're of similar age. You'd go to the supermarket and you come out of the supermarket and somebody would have put flyers under all of the windshield wipers, right? For some universal church of this or that, or this was social media in the 70s, right? So when people were denied the airwaves or what have you, this is how they got their message across. And they were invariably kooks, but this is why they wouldn't have been allowed near the airwaves. Now, somebody might say, so great, so they allowed the New York Times on the airwaves, who were lying to you about the right-wing death squads in Central America. And in other words, there's always a case to be made that you were being cheated and lied to and that we don't want gatekeepers, and I don't want gatekeepers in the media. But having gatekeepers in the media may be an integral part of that analog creation that we call nation states, and they may not be able to survive effectively without that. So where does that go? In other words, if a liberal democracy requires freedom of thought and freedom of research and all of that kind of stuff, but that line crosses the line between the ability of the state to control information meaningfully so we don't have conspiracy theories running crazy that divide the... In other words, you see what I'm saying? There may be two lines here that intersect, that can't intersect peacefully or well.
Yeah, and there's certainly this tension between kooks and gatekeepers. And this actually brings me to what could be the last question here. It's been a somewhat grim season for amateur historians such as yourself.
Who said it was never not grim for amateur historians?
I'm thinking about the Exhibit A, Daryl Cooper. I imagine that name is not unknown to you. This is the amateur historian who not that long ago went on Tucker Carlson's podcast and told the world that Winston Churchill had actually been the bad guy in World War II, and the Holocaust had happened more or less by accident. The Nazis never intended to kill the Jews. They just found that they had too many prisoners of war and couldn't feed them all. And wouldn't it be more compassionate to gas people? And so millions of people ended up dead. That's a quote. In any case, then he went on Joe Rogan's podcast. And, you know, I think on those two podcasts alone, you had this, the charitable description is iconoclastic amateur historian, given an audience that is probably larger than any real historian has ever had. And again, so we have no gatekeepers, we have gatekeepers who are podcasters who are either not doing their homework or have some ideological commitment in Tucker's case that is probably fairly sinister. This is very, perhaps, too close to the bone for you, given your job description. But how do you view this? Well, I mean, what is the remedy for this moment where you have people just asking questions about the Holocaust and spinning up anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and to the largest possible audience?
It's weird. They used to describe the political spectrum when I was in college as not as a line, but as a horseshoe, and that the right and the left wings start looking a little like each other when they get far enough to the extremes. How funny that it would take a right-wing historian, or wannabe historian, I guess, to demonize Churchill in a way that the left would appreciate right. as they spray paint his statue in Trafalgar Square or wherever. So it's interesting. Here's what I would say, Sam, and this is how I've always felt about this. There has always been a group of people that find the Nazis interesting, and it runs the gamut from people who like the politics, right, to people who want to belong to a bigger movement, to people who feel some racial identity, to people that don't like Jews, to people that, I mean, there's a million. Some of them just love the pageantry or the marching in step or the great, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why
the Hugo Boss designed.
Yes. The uniforms, the line from Dragnet where the black guy stands up in the audience and tells the police officers that you're all a bunch of Nazis, but you don't dress as nice. But here's the thing. I always ask this question. When people do the revisionist, and revisionist history is not a bad word, ladies and gentlemen, it's actually a good word most of the time, but when people do this, we're going to look at Nazi Germany again, I always ask, why? And it's not because there's not good reasons to, because there always are, but what is your reason for doing that? And invariably, you find people that Well, for example, let's just take David Irving, who supposedly is one of the works that Mr. Cooper used in his thing. Okay, but David Irving's been a long time ago. They figured out that David Irving likes Nazis. It doesn't mean he likes killing Jews, but he's into it the way that we all know some people are. I mean, Lemmy from Motorhead collected Nazi memorabilia. He wasn't a Nazi. He was just into it. So some of these people like this stuff. And so what I always say to them is, what is your point? Why do you feel this need? If a real historian says, we have this underserved fable about the Nazis that I want to correct, no axe to grind, but I just want to make the historical record reflect reality. That's one thing. But most of these people don't. They have something about that era or that figure in Hitler or the Nazis or something about Jews or whatever it might be that sticks in their craw in a way that they want to see the record made straight, whatever that means. Inherently right there is your problem. There's something about, they're not an honest broker. They're doing this for a reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is.
And it might not be that they hate Jews. I'm not, but I like goose stepping guys in flashy uniforms. Like you said, the Hugo Boss stuff, who knows?
Yeah. It's hard to know. I mean, I find that I do not have a theory of mind that I am confident in when I look at somebody like Cooper. I don't know him. I know at least one person who knows him and swears he's a good guy, right? So I don't know.
But Sam, it's like when they say 6 million Jews didn't really die in the Holocaust. So I say, okay, so it's 5 million. Does that fundamentally change anything?
Right.
I mean, what are we arguing? Why are we having the argument? Right. So that's the part that always gets to me. Like, why is this so important to you to get that number lower? Right. So who cares? It's an evil movement. And if you don't think it's an evil movement and you want to write a revisionist history saying the Nazis weren't really evil like you, because remember, the Germans had their own way. The pro-Nazis had their own way of portraying this. They were the bulwark against communism. Right. They were defending the entire Western world from communism. But you go read legitimate histories. And the part that people don't pay enough attention to is they were kooks. The Nazis were conspiracy kooks. And they were, for the most part, incompetent at the highest levels. I mean, what saved Germany was everybody sort of in the medium and lower levels in terms of, I mean, otherwise, the Second World War is over a lot sooner because the decisions being made at the ultimate high levels were just terrible. That's why I always argue that the First World War Germany, the Kaiserreich, is so much more competent and formidable than the Second World War Germany, because Second World War Germany has a bunch of conspiracy freaks in charge who think the protocols of the Elders of Zion is real, you know?
Also, the details of the Holocaust are so astounding. I mean, when you just we take specifically what happened at the various death camps like Treblinka, that it's this is a point that the Nazis who ran the camps were conscious of. I mean, I think it's Primo Levi. It might be someone else, but somebody who survived the Holocaust and wrote about it wrote that an SS guard said this explicitly, upon the liberation of the camps, when the war was over and the Germans had lost, one of these guys said to, one of the Jews being liberated that no one's going to believe you that any of this happened, right? You understand.
That's why Eisenhower had people tour the camps.
There was an acknowledgement that this was so extreme. And when you take something like, Treblinka, where they create a fake train station so as to make people think that they're just going to be resettled in the East, and all the levels of deception that were necessary to pull this off. And
wasn't Hitler supposed to have said, "Who now remembers the Armenians?" I mean, it's easy to make people disappear and then forget about it. But I would make the distinction, Sam, because there's another distinction, and it runs very similar to some we've made earlier in this conversation between two kinds of people. One kind of person who says that the Holocaust never happened, and I'm interested in making sure that gets out there because I don't think it happened, I think it's wrong, versus people who admit it happened and wanted it to happen.
Right.
So I think there's some crossover between those two people. Like, some of those people know it happened, are glad it happened, but can't say publicly that they're glad it happened. And there's other people that legitimately don't believe it happened and the Nazis are getting a bad rep. There's
a third category that's actually morally worse in my view. There are the people, I mean, you find this among, jihadists and Islamists, the people who claim it didn't happen, but it should have happened. And if they could, get their hands on the wheel, they would bring it about, right? So there's...
Yeah. Well, and you can see that, one of the things that's not portrayed, there's a lot of problems in the world, right? But but you go look at some of the stuff after the Second World War, right? When we should know better, when we understand what, and I mean, go look at the stuff in the Middle East from the wars of the 1950s. There was a lot of Nazi, you know, I mean, it's paraphernalia and symbols.
Well,
and
Nazis themselves. I mean, there were Nazis who were.
There were Nazis themselves. That's right. Well, the Mufti was friends with, you know, all those. But the point is that if we're going to start talking about age-old hatreds that human beings have for one another, this seems almost like the original sin. And we the fact that we can be in a 21st century world when we've landed on the moon and all these sorts of things, and we still have this ancient problem where multi-ethnic societies going back to ancient Persia were trying to iron out the problems of trying to rule a whole bunch of different peoples with different cultures, different religions, and we're still dealing with it today, is there's something inherently interesting about that side of our human personality, I think. Tragic and interesting.
Yeah, well, there will undoubtedly be a first fist fight on Mars if we ever get there, or a first hate crime. And yeah, we predicted it here, Dan.
That's right. Put it in stone.
As always, it's so great to talk to you, Dan. Thank you for
taking the time. It's been a long time. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. And listen, congratulations on all the great success.
Oh.
Video. Well, look at you on video, man.
Yeah, well, or don't.
Not going to happen to me.
It's someday, Dan. We'll drag you here.
I live in the analog world as much as I can, my friend.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Dan.
Thank you for having me, buddy.